Hi, I'm David Crow. Thank you for tuning in to episode 98 of my weekly radio show, The Infectious Myth. Email me at david.crow@theinfectiousmyth.com. That's Crow with an E. Like us or join the discussion at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth or follow us on Twitter at infectiousmyth. You can listen to us live at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, or after the broadcast, you can download the MP3 on iTunes or other podcast programs. And remember, I don't know you're a listener until I hear from you. If you send me a message letting me know how you stay in touch with the show, and if you include your mailing address, I will send you a little thank you gift. If you'd like to sponsor this show as an individual or as an advertiser, please contact me. We appreciate all our listeners, but if you want this show to continue to grow and improve, consider paying a small amount for the information that you are gleaning, for the support that you get for some non-mainstream ideas, and the challenges that you get to others. This is a long interview this week, so I don't have a lot of time for feedback, but I did want to mention my skepticism of a new article in the New England Journal of Medicine, Zika Virus and Birth Defects, Reviewing the Evidence for Causality. One of my reasons for skepticism is that the authors are mostly from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, and the sinister-sounding Division of Public Health Information Dissemination. And it's sinister because this is basically the Division of Public Health propaganda. What the CDC is doing is they're laundering very shoddy data about Zika virus and microcephaly through the New England Journal of Medicine, so they can now turn around and with the imprimatur of the New England Journal of Medicine, claim that the association has been proven. In their conclusions, they write this: "Thus, on the basis of a review of the available evidence, using both criteria that are specific for the evaluation of potential teratogens, that's things that cause birth defects, and the Bradford-Hill criteria as frameworks, we suggest that sufficient evidence is accumulated to infer a causal relationship between perinatal Zika virus infection and microcephaly and other severe brain anomalies. Also supportive of a causal relationship is the absence of an alternative explanation, despite the extensive consideration of possible causes." Now, this is a bald-faced lie. There's no mention in this paper about the addition of a larvicide to the drinking water, of exposure to pesticides in the air in a very agricultural area, or of the potential impact of prenatal vaccines on the fetus. They continue, "Researchers have been unable to identify alternative hypotheses that could explain the increase in cases of microcephaly that were observed first in Brazil and then retrospectively in French Polynesia and now in preliminary reports that are being investigated in Colombia." Again, I'd like to interject that both of these things, microcephaly and Zika virus, are susceptible to ascertainment bias. Nobody was looking for either of them until recently, and then you start looking and you start finding them. You start testing women for Zika, you find women testing positive, but there is no widespread survey, global survey, that shows what's the background rate of people who test positive for the Zika virus. It might be quite high. We just don't know. So if I go back to this trashy piece of work in the New England Journal of Medicine, moving from a hypothesis that Zika virus is linked to certain adverse outcomes to a statement that Zika virus is a cause of certain adverse outcomes allows for A, direct communications regarding risk. So now they can unleash the propaganda, both in clinical care settings and in public health guidance. An intensified focus on prevention efforts, such as the implementation of vector control. This means mosquito spraying. I don't know if you knew it, but the Centers for Disease Control was established as a mosquito spraying organization, and this is what they like to do best. Spray pesticides on people and then ignore the consequences of spraying pesticides on people's health. Continued, the identification of improved diagnostic methods. Zika virus tests. Ka-ching, ka-ching. Somebody's going to make a lot of money off this. Finally, the development of a Zika virus vaccine. And this is probably where the big money is. The struggling government of Brazil, which is currently in the middle of a constitutional crisis, will now be told that they've got to spend millions of dollars paying for mosquito spraying, a Zika virus test kits, and very soon, Zika virus vaccines. Just what the Brazilian people don't need. Today, I'm joined by my How Positive Are You co-host, Elizabeth Ely, to interview Martin Walker. Among many other things he has accomplished in 30 years of social activism, Martin has written Dirty Medicine, which describes how shadowy people in AstroTurf organizations attacked anyone who criticized medical dogmas, even mildly. He documents the actions of one Duncan Campbell, who went after the critics of the first AIDS drug, AZT. Since the drug directly interferes with DNA synthesis, it was, and still is, because it's still used, a deadly toxin. In this book, he describes the early days of Brian Deere, when he was a critic of the Pharm Mafia, as Walker describes the drug industry, and before Deere became the leading attacker of Andrew Wakefield. Welcome to the show, Martin.
Since 1988 or so, the only campaigns I've been involved in have been health campaigns and medical campaigns.
It seems like that's where the greatest amount of corruption is, and possibly the greatest number of people being killed. I'm not sure if the military can actually exceed the number of people killed by the medical industry.
It's not in vaccination isn't the biggest area of death and injury from pharmaceuticals. It's all kinds of pharmaceuticals. I mean, Vioxx has killed 100,000 people. 100,000 people. And that's an FDA figure, not a conspiracy theorist figure.
And that would be just in the United States.
Right.
Yeah, that's huge.
Well, there was a paper in 1998 that estimated that 106,000 Americans are killed by properly prescribed pharmaceuticals in hospitals. So if you include improper prescriptions such as overdose, wrong drug, wrong method of delivery, et cetera, and if you consider drugs prescribed outside hospitals such as nursing homes, over-the-counter, mental institutions, things like that, some people have estimated that, and if you include things like surgical errors, some people have estimated 1 million a year. There's a ton of people killed by drugs in particular.
The biggest area in this is the medical area, and I'm sure, I don't know whether David agrees with me, but this is because of the pharmaceutical companies. The pharmaceutical companies seem to have become the largest corporations with the greatest extent of influence, and not only have they become that, but they've determinedly planned that. So your average pharmaceutical corporation will have people everywhere, in every different profession, in every different institution, in all kinds of political situations.
They've planned this kind of influence over society.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
Why?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, there's the obvious answer, and that is for profit. Mm. But yeah. Some people say that there are less obvious answers.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think the profits that you can get from producing a chemical, claiming that it has life-saving properties, and then selling it for 100,000, 10,000 times more than what you manufactured it. I mean, The profits are so obscene, it's pretty easy to get sucked into believing your own propaganda, that you really are saving lives, and at the same time, you're making yourself fabulously wealthy.
Yeah, yeah, and in the case of vaccines, I think that the costs and the safety standards are low, is what I've read. And yet there's no liability or very little. There's something called the vaccine court in the United States. I mean, it's very limited liability plus the prospect of huge profits when people are mandated to take these things. So I would imagine that the temptation is huge. But I think that what Martin was saying, if I could get back to your answer, you were saying, you know, you just can't explain this by money alone.
Leave that for a moment and go back to what you said about the vaccine injury court in America and the vaccine damage court in Britain. That this was a deliberate construction of an apparently judicial situation which avoided civil claims for damages in legal courts. So you've got the whole of the vaccine industry has hived off its responsibilities, taken them out of the proper courts and put them in to these special vaccine courts, which yes. don't have the same standards, which don't have the same witnesses, don't have the same expert witness position, and lots of other things.
Right.
They're lesser courts. And, I mean, you probably know that Andy Wakefield was tried in the court of the General Medical Council, which has an even lower standard than any of the other courts.
Right, right. And this was kind of a pseudo-criminal kind of action against him. And as I understand, it was only because he came forward and was willing to testify as an expert witness in this massive civil lawsuit that the victims of this had against the government or pharmaceutical companies or something in Britain.
The victims against of MMR.
Yeah, the victims of the MMR, the measles, yeah. mumps, rubella vaccine.
Against three pharmaceutical companies, 1,500 damaged children.
Yeah.
And can you describe what happened to that court case?
It disappeared off the face of the earth.
Well, because, yeah, how was it made to disappear?
Yeah, no, sorry, I'll tell you that, David.
Yeah, okay.
In America, you have a system whereby if a law firm believes that it can win a case, it goes ahead with the case on a no-win, no-fee.
Right, that's called contingency.
Right.
Well, we've never had that in England. And so in England, whenever a company takes on a case or a lawyer, particularly a single lawyer, takes on a case, they do it for money, and that's all they'll do it for. They won't do it on a charitable basis and then get their money back if they win the case. So because court cases cost so much money, there has always been in existence in England a legal aid system. The legal aid system entails defendants of all kinds to get money on solid grounds from the government in order to pursue the defense of their case, or in civil actions, the prosecution of their case. And in the MMR civil litigation, it was worked on and constructed over a decade. Over 10 years, the lawyers worked with the defendants, with the damaged parties,
right.
to establish an appearance in court, a final appearance in court, which would judge the whole matter. And about 9 months or 6 months after a decade's work, before the case was to come to court, the government withdrew legal aid. So
yes.
leaving all the lawyers working in the case would have ended up in poverty if they'd have gone ahead and they'd lost the case. So they all dropped out of it.
Right. And that the time frame we're talking about here is 1995 to, I believe, 2003, correct?
2004, the final appeal against the dropping of legal aid went through.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes. So everything was dropped, and the scientists, including Dr. Wakefield, who were scheduled to be expert witnesses in that case, perhaps they hadn't even testified yet, I don't know, they were also like charged with crimes against science for agreeing to do this.
I like your crimes against science. That's very good. I like that
yeah.
a lot.
Crimes against humanity, crimes against science,
now,
whatever.
What?
They were bad scientists for even agreeing to participate in this.
What happened was that as soon as the claim for damages was dropped, I would say some claimants went ahead with other kinds of action, but none of them came to anything. So it's best just to discount that. and those people were never heard from again. I know that's a horrible way of putting it, but that's the truth of the matter.
No, the word disappeared has been used.
And then, that's right, then between 2000, well, Brian Deer started his public campaign.
This is a journalist. Journalist Brian Deer.
You could call him that, although yeah. Journalism does tend to be quite an ethical profession on the whole, and Brian Deer certainly wasn't one of those people. He started his campaign just after the appeal against the withdrawal of legal aid and the dropping of the cases. And that accused, in 2004, accused Andy Wakefield particularly of all kinds of crime, things to do with making money, things to do with unethical operations and ways of dealing with children.
Uh-huh. Andrew Wakefield is a medical doctor, and he was actually in practice in addition to being involved in some research. And no, did he actually see patients? I know that he did research.
No, he didn't. His contract at the Royal Free Hospital was a contract entirely to carry out research.
Okay, but he was a medical doctor, an MD.
The reason why his contract was such was because he was qualified above his station, so to speak, that he was too young to be a reader. And so when he took on the job at the Royal Free Hospital, they gave him the job of head of the research department, but only that. He could only do that. He couldn't see patients.
Mm-hmm.
But he was working with one of the greatest child doctors in Europe, some say in the world, which was Professor Walker Smith, right? Both of them agreed to be expert witnesses for the children. And there was another person put on trial as well, who was a doctor and is now a professor, and he was called Simon Murch. So you had three people in the dock, but it began with Brian Deer's attack on Andrew Wakefield. And his attack was in the Sunday Times, Rupert Murdoch's Sunday Times. And it was extensive, rambling, incoherent, and sometimes completely illogical. But intermeshed with the text was a call by the head of, I think he was the head of health at that time, the politician, and the Prime Minister, Tony Blair, that Wakefield's case be taken immediately before the General Medical Council.
And this is kind of a licensing board for professionals of this type?
It's the professional body. It's the body, the professional body for doctors in Britain. They organise everything to do with the doctors' welfare, doctors' licensing, as you said, and also doctors' misdemeanours.
Right, and normally when a doctor misbehaves, these professional associations do their best to try to protect the doctor, but they have the power to destroy a doctor's career, and when you cross a line such as criticizing vaccination, they'll turn on you, and they'll do what they're supposed to do when there's a doctor who's doing botched surgery and killing patients and that kind of thing.
Yeah, sometimes they won't.
Yeah.
Sometimes they'll defend them.
Yes, that's what I mean.
What they're supposed to do is defend them.
They've got a very... The General Medical Council in England has got a very bad reputation in terms of its judicial inquiries into doctors who killed people.
Yeah.
They actually let go Britain's most renowned mass murderer. After two hearings, they decided that there was nothing much wrong with him at all. oddly enough, the police officer who handled that case, or handled a case of the most extensive serial killer at that time, went on
serial
to work
killer,
for the GMC.
You mean a medical serial killer?
The person that the GMC looked into was a doctor, and he became Britain's biggest massacre. And he was a doctor who killed elderly patients. The GMC, in looking into it, failed on two occasions to find him guilty of anything. Anyway, it's just an aside. It doesn't really mean anything at all.
Right.
Yeah.
Dr. Simon Murch was at the end of the three-year trial by the General Medical Council. Dr. Simon Murch was told off but went back to work. Professor Walker Smith was told that there would be no sentence against him until after his appeal. Dr. Wakefield was found guilty of all the charges against him. We're talking about something like 80 charges against these doctors.
80? My goodness.
80, yes, 80. Some major, some minor, some peripheral, whatever, right? Under about 10 or 11 headings. When the hearing was over, Wakefield was found guilty on all counts, including counts of dishonesty. Professor Walker Smith was found guilty of all the accounts, but not of any dishonesty charges. And Simon Murch was never charged with any dishonesty counts, and he was found guilty of most of the counts, but he was just reprimanded. Bearing in mind that this General Medical Council hearing is not a proper court, the next step was to appeal to the High Court. That's the High Court in the Strand, which hears all the appeals for everybody up and down.
Right. Kind of like the Supreme Court in
America.
That's
right. And it has proper judges and proper legal people. And it's watched continuously. Professor Walker Smith and Dr. Wakefield had both to apply for an appeal. Walker Smith's appeal was accepted by the High Court, and he went to a three-day hearing in front of a High Court judge. Dr. Wakefield's appeal was not granted. If you've heard him say he was not afforded due process, this is what he means. The appeal court in London has what I think is a quite peculiar idea of when a person should be granted an appeal and when they shouldn't be granted an appeal. And that is whether or not there is 52% possibility of them winning their case. In Professor Walker Smith's case, he was allowed his appeal because his lawyers thought that he could win that appeal, and the appeal court agreed with them. In Andy Wakefield's case, his lawyers didn't think he had a chance of winning an appeal, and the appeal court agreed with them. When Professor Walker Smith had his appeal, the judge completely and utterly exonerated him.
Of all 80 or so charges?
Of every single charge that he had been found guilty of, he said, basically, and I'll paraphrase him, the GMC trial was rubbish. The panel, that is, the jury, made up of three lay people, didn't understand the evidence, and it was a completely wrongful conviction.
But it was on the same basis that Wakefield was convicted and he wasn't afforded an appeal.
Yes, that's right. What was left to Andy after his appeal had been turned down, the possibility of an appeal had been turned down, right? After the hearing, the GMC hearing, was finished, Brian Deer, at the behest of his pharmaceutical masters, wrote three more articles in the British Medical Journal. And they took to the final hypothesis what he said Wakefield had done. And that was he had completely concocted his definition of the children looked at in the first paper in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
And he had said they had inflammatory bowel disease, which in some cases had led to autism.
Right.
And Deer said, no, they didn't have inflammatory bowel disease on the whole. So on the basis of those three articles, Andy decided to sue the BMJ and Brian Deer and Godley, who's the editor of the BMJ. And after a lot of argument in and out of court, the court decided in America, because that's where Andy's living now,
right,
decided that it was not with the case was not within their jurisdiction.
Right. Didn't evidence come out that independently another expert had diagnosed the children in the same way as Andy Wakefield?
There is lots of evidence, David. I mean, the fact is, it's just, as in other cases of this kind, the evidence just doesn't get into the court, or the evidence is cherry-picked, or, no, I mean, let's look at the GMC case just very briefly. There's, I can't remember, there was 13 cases in the original paper in 1998 in The Lancet.
Right.
Now, all Wakefield did, along with 12 other doctors who were signatories to that paper,
right,
was he looked at 13 children who had been admitted sequentially to the Royal Free Hospital and tried to find, through diagnostic tests, tried to find how they could be treated.
Right,
obviously,
right.
Before you treat somebody, you've got to find out what's wrong with them. And mm-hmm. that's what they were doing with those 13 children. And the paper that Andy Wakefield wrote was a case review paper. Had nothing to do with research. It said, you know, roughly, just to paraphrase, it said, of these 13 children, 8 of them had inflammatory bowel disease. 4 of them had regressive autism. Some of them were evidently susceptible to certain environmental influences or whatever. So what you've got is a case review paper, which then goes on to be discussed in meetings, and doctors make up their mind what kinds of tests to pursue in order to find a way of treating these children.
Right.
That's what you're talking about.
And that's quite normal. I've seen several, you know, many papers where they will line up 2, 3, 4, a dozen patients that have somewhat similar treatments or conditions, and then try to analyze and draw some generalizations.
It's not a comprehensive clinical study. And if I could move ahead a little bit to move forward on this, you know, as you say, it only recommended, as I understand, further study of perhaps a link between the children's condition and maybe one of several causes being proposed as the MMR vaccine. And being a case review, it was not a comprehensive, like, clinical study involving thousands of kids. It was 13 people. So it was just a heads up saying, we need more research on this because we think we might have identified something. And then fast forward to the United States, where the CDC actually did conduct that study. And that's what Vaxxed, the movie, is about. It's about what happened with that study. And what happened with that study was that data on African-American children, specifically African-American male children, was deleted from the study. And various other manipulations went on, and ways that it was conducted that were not reputable and that people knew were not reputable. And all they did was send memos around about how to cover their backsides over it. So, and that was the study that was called for. Can you comment on what happened there?
No, yes, that's completely correct. It needn't have been that specific study, because I don't know what it would have been looking at. I mean, we don't know that, because there was no more research. That was the end of it. But I think that it's important to point out a couple of other things which give us an idea of why all of a sudden the house collapsed. Andy went to a press briefing, which was held by the university hospital. The authors of the paper, those that were there at that press briefing, were asked questions. One question was fielded to Andy, and that was, what would you expect parents to do now with this concern about regressive autism? And Andy answered it in the way that he had told the organisers of the briefing he would answer it, and that was, it would seem prudent for parents to choose single vaccines. It had been in existence in Britain for the last 20 years prior to this. The mumps vaccine was added to MMR completely out of the blue. There was no need for it. Nobody ever asked for it. And the NHS guiding principles on vaccine said, we don't really need it, except in extreme cases. So that was thrown in to the MMR without any guidance or anybody really wanting it or there being any scientific necessity for it. When he said people should return or use the single vaccine, that completely confronted the British government's vaccine policy. They spent thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon millions of pounds advertising their first British-produced triple vaccine. And this was the way they were going to go. All the government reports prior to the MMR said, we've got to go forward with multiple vaccines. And there was Wakefield just told the parents of any child who's going to get vaccinated, please use the single vaccine.
By multiple vaccines, you mean one vaccine with multiple components, multiple...
Yes.
Yeah. Well, I think that he felt that it, just to be on the safe side, that parents...
Of course.
According to what he saw as a scientist, honestly, he said, you should err on the safe side, and until we get the full study done, which may prove that it's all safe, you might think of, you know, just doing this. Yeah.
But what the government thought was that he was completely destroying their vaccine policy.
Right.
Yes.
So,
how dare he?
But he wasn't taking an anti-vaccine stance. He wasn't saying that I think the MMR vaccine is dangerous. He was saying there's alternatives and you should use the alternatives. But I guess he, like you say, the ego of the government, which is put their ego on the line by saying we've come up with this great new scheme, he was totally undercutting that.
Just off the top of your heads, tell me what the government did next. Apart from attacking Andy Wakefield, just tell me what
probably
they did
increased
next.
Their advertising of the MMR vaccine.
They did that, very good, yes, but they did something much more profound than that in relation to Andy Wakefield.
I can't guess. You'll have to tell us.
Yes, they, please.
They made a statement saying that there would be no more licensing of single vaccines.
Okay. So you can't
okay.
get the singles.
Checkmate.
One thing that came up with the multiple vaccines that I thought was actually very interesting is that Most vaccines, like when I was a kid in the 60s, we were told one vaccine, lifetime immunity, blah, blah, blah. Now it's increasingly true that you need to get multiple shots of one vaccine because it's admitted it doesn't give you lifetime immunity. So if you put three vaccines into one shot, and one of the vaccines needs, say, an annual booster, and another one needs a once every 10 years, and the other is every 5 years, you cannot apply the vaccines appropriately if you got them all in the same shot.
There's the other thing as well, and that is that some people would believe, some people of scientific-minded people would believe that mixing viruses is a downward path towards serious illness, you know. And that's why your doctor's supposed to ask you if your child has had any kind of cold or flu or anything like that, or strep throat or whatever, in the last month or so. Because mixing vaccine strains can cause serious illness. And that has never been sorted out. And they've produced these compound viruses, vaccines, but they haven't actually sorted out the problem of whether or not you can get ill from mixing vaccines.
Right, right. So if I may, I'd like to shift to your excellent work on so-called astroturfing and the conflicts of interest of organizations. I believe you have been exposing this since at least 1988, astroturfing being the creation of fake grassroots organizations that are really pharmaceutical fronts or corporate fronts for various causes. We've seen this in climate change. We've seen this in, you know, tobacco cases in the United States. We never see the faces of the people or the identities even who censor our films, who go after our scientists' careers. We never see who's ultimately behind it. It's they use other people, and oftentimes innocent people who believe they've joined a reputable organization. And I think it's really a fascinating topic, and I'm so glad that I get to talk to you about it because you are the expert. So, and these are supposed to be activist groups. Activist groups don't usually operate in the dark like this. They stand up and get counted publicly for their views. But in the case of Positive Hell, we don't even know the names of the alleged LGBT student groups who were threatening to protest the showing of this film at the London Independent Film Festival.
And if I can just interject, Positive Hell, I've interviewed on the Infectious Myth, Joan Shenton, is the story of quite a significant number of people, but it's actually just a story of a small number of them who've been HIV positive for decades, who only took drugs for a short time, if at all, and have generally retained their health over that period. I believe one of them died for other causes. Just a little background on the film.
Yeah. And we've also interviewed people associated with the film on How Positive Are You? And so, you know, are these legitimate groups sometimes, are they just brainwashed by AIDS propaganda, or are they illegitimate front groups? I don't know personally how this happens. Do you?
As you say, I've done a lot of work on it. But I think that you're homing in on the problem in the wrong way. I think it's best to look at the universe of it to start with, right?
Okay.
The universe of it is that pharmaceutical companies will do anything to sell a product. And if it's damaging, if it kills people, they'll still go on trying to sell the product. And there are 100 ways of creating an environment and a motivation for people to buy and them to sell their products. All those ways are anti-democratic, are corporate, are subversive in the sense of truth or dogma or whatever. And most of them involve propaganda.
Okay. rather than paying off these groups, most of it would be just they buy the propaganda.
I think there's lots of different groups, right? And
yes.
Like on Facebook, there's lots of shills and people who are paid by the pharmaceutical companies, but who never say a word about pharmaceuticals. They just occasionally, they might drop a hint here or there. And they might be being paid pin money. They might be given a boost up in their job or whatever. You don't know these things. I mean, in some cases, you do know them because the research has been done. And it's what I spent most of my life doing over the last 20 years. But I don't think of it as this group in London at the university who's criticising Jones' film. Forget it. Go bigger.
That's what I intend to do. That's why what I'm asking you.
Multi-million pound plans of pharmaceutical companies. You know, pharmaceutical companies spend more money on their propaganda than they do on their product.
Right.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah, more money on marketing than development.
Exactly. And when you think about it, this is an enormous field. I mean, Hitler had it just about organized for Germany. But this is for our world we're talking about. And we're talking about getting people to buy drugs and stopping adverse criticism of those drugs. It's a massive project. Sorry.
Yeah, and even when drugs get withdrawn, if they can delay the withdrawal for 5 or 10 years,
of course,
they can make billions of dollars in that time. So they don't really care
if
they know it's going
to
get pulled.
Even if it's withdrawn, they sell it to Brazil.
Right. That's true.
Or somewhere, Uruguay.
It's like Canada has banned asbestos use in Canada, but it still sells it to other countries.
It's just terrible, isn't it?
I think the point is well taken, that it's a huge propaganda operation and that we've got these possibly innocent organizations who, you know, they can point to as, oh, the LGBT groups were going to protest. Oh, how terrible. But it's really interesting to know who's behind this, and they're not necessarily paying off the groups. They've just created such a saturation environment of propaganda.
Well, can I ask
that,
Martin if he has an example?
Yeah.
I mean, do you have a particularly shocking example of how this propaganda works from the pharmaceutical companies on down?
That's really difficult to answer. Just let me give you a very simple... this was in my book, Dirty Medicine, in my first Dirty Medicine book. But if you look at what Wellcome did at the time of producing AZT...
And Wellcome is now GlaxoSmithKline.
It's gone into GlaxoSmithKline, yeah. And they took all their dirty tricks with them, and they were the best. Wellcome had the best dirty tricks in the business, and they took them into GlaxoSmithKline. And I think you can figure out that a lot of the dirty tricks come from the laboratory of Wellcome, which has now gone in with GlaxoSmithKline. At the time of AZT being produced, Wellcome Foundation, not the Wellcome Trust, Wellcome Foundation employed a business analyst company to give them a report on what Wellcome should be worried about in the case of AZT. How could they protect it from serious criticism and from being overthrown, so to speak? The company came out with a list of things, which, very sensible list. It looked at everything. One of the items said simply, you have to beware of anybody finding a cure for AIDS.
Heaven forbid.
That would be devastating.
That would certainly do away with AZT, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, that is a signal sentence, because it says they were protecting AZT not because it was good for the public health and it was going to save thousands of lives, but because it was all they had, and they threw it out there, and they made God knows how much, 200 million out of it or whatever. But their own company, their own advisors told them, you've got to beware, you know. Somebody finds a cure for AIDS, and it'll go right down the pan.
Right, all that investment in AZT, which actually wasn't that much because it was the research was done by the U.S.
Yeah,
government.
Yeah, it was taken off the shelf, wasn't
yes,
it?
Yes.
Another thing that they did at that time, and this is what got me involved in this situation, they set up this group called the Campaign Against Health Fraud. And that might have looked, Elizabeth, like a set of relatively innocent people who just get pushed the wrong way, but they weren't. They were a definite group with a definite brief, and the brief was to make sure that everybody believed in drug trials in the same way that Wellcome and the pharmaceutical companies did, and that nobody, but nobody, believed in alternative medicine or in using homeopathy or in using acupuncture or in using Ayurvedic medicine.
Or in the case of a positive HIV test, doing nothing because you reject the validity of the test.
Right.
Or just taking care of your health or just recommending that Africans get something to eat, you know?
No,
I've heard that described as by the word insidious. That's an insidious idea. And in the United States, we, I think until recently, it might have closed down, there was a website called Quack Watch, and it just tears to bits anything that isn't, you know, chemically and surgically based, as
that's
if, you know, the universe were organized around that.
Websites that are linked to the original Campaign Against Health Fraud. I mean, the organizations they set up in, when was it, 1988, were in Britain and America. And they had more or less the same names, and they were they employed the same kinds of people, and they were usually dogmatic non-scientists who were very good at propaganda. And these groups just sprang up like wildfire and attacked everybody in sight.
Right.
Took people before the General Medical Council, took legal action against some of the cases in America. Some people went to prison, you know. I mean, this has been going on. This is one of the things that infuriates me, that this has been going on since 1988 or so, and in some cases before that. I mean, some herbal medicines have been outlawed before that and some herbalists sent to prison. But when you think that they'd set up this system in 1988 and it's now, what is it?
2016.
And all we've got is a massive proliferation of these groups and an extension of them. And they've just grown and grown and grown. And the individuals who lead them are grown and, you know, and they're all having books written for them. And, you know, I mean, Mr. Offit sounds very good, and his books about what would Jesus say about vaccination sounds very good. But who wrote it? That's what I want to know.
Yes.
Because that's an absolutely typical, long-standing intelligence trick, is to get a writer to put his name to a book written by the intelligence services. There are hundreds of them, these books, you look at them and they're just incredible.
Yeah. Well, we actually protested a book called Denialism by a writer for the New Yorker. And he, you know, we did research on the guy, and he was given awards by these groups that were supported by chemical companies, including Monsanto and all these pharmaceutical companies. And nobody cared to even look into that. They're just like, well, this sounds scientific because it's violent.
That is the level playing field now.
Yes. It occurs to me that science is synonymous with domination these days, that's the image that they put forward. It's not about anything soft and sweet.
It's synonymous with truth. That's what they put forward. Science is truth.
Is Pravda.
Yes. Well, if it were real science, it would admit that it's just an investigation and that there may be further investigations. And I'm interested in this group called Autism Speaks, because it seems like it's sort of broken from the groups that are willing to consider that vaccines are linked with autism. And there seems to be like two camps of groups in the autism thing. And one of these groups that Autism Speaks belongs to and has been criticized for is they advance the idea that autism is something you can't do anything about. It's genetic. And that we'll someday get to the bottom of it by prescribing the right pharmaceuticals, and we'll get a cure. There's always that elusive cure for things, yeah. Right? There's never been a cure for anything. And then there's and the other thing that we'll do is gene therapy. So we'll mess with people's genes. So and anyone even suggesting the vaccine autism link is just kind of laughed out of these groups. And actually, it's been suggested that one research institute at New York University, whose ex-husband heads it or is on the board, I think he's on the board, it's like the NYU Child Study Center, studies exactly that, the genetic origin of autism, mm-hmm. and that his ex-wife is one of the founders of the Tribeca Film Festival. So there's been a lot of speculation that right. she was involved in getting vaxxed, kicked out of the festival. And she's appeared with Robert De Niro on TV, and she looks extremely uncomfortable with his insistence that everybody just should see this film anyway, because he has a kid with autism.
She looks like his handler.
Consider this.
Like
his handler, yeah.
She's supposed to keep De Niro under control. That's her job, and just remind him that anything you say might be dangerous, and people are going to die if you say anything bad about vaccines.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Also, I mentioned her to someone last night, a well-known writer, and he said, "Oh, he adores Jane Rosenthal. She's a wonderful person." And I'm thinking, well, of course she's a wonderful person. Of course she wants to help humanity. Of course she's not some greedy, money-grubbing person. She does have a lot of money, but I don't think it comes from this. I was reminded of a quote by Ginger Taylor of healthchoice.org. She's the mother of an autistic son. And she says, and I quote, "They expand the corruption and gain new defenders by lying to naive parties who don't know they are defending fraud and corruption, thereby implicating them in the fraud and corruption, and then forcing them to defend CDC fraud by defending themselves."
The thing is, Elizabeth, I could have made a full-time occupation out of looking at these groups and these people.
Yes.
In the 60s, when I was expelled from college after a long occupation, the term was class war. Well, we don't have that anymore,
right.
Unfortunately.
We've become people.
There's another war going on, and it's the corporate war against citizens. And unless society as a whole looks at this politically and understands what we can do about it or how we can change it, we're never going to get anywhere. We could spend days and hours and months and weeks looking at individuals and groups that have got this money and that money, and they do this and they do that, and they link to this and they link to that. But the problem is, corporations are beginning to control governments, and corporatism is beginning to control society. And until we look at it in some kind of vaguely what they used to call political terms, we're not going to change anything.
Yeah, yes. The way I look at it is that these corporations have found a way to make bucket loads of money, and I think you can make a parallel between pharmaceuticals and the military-industrial complex, and they download the negative consequences of what they do on us. So if a child is injured, that may well that child may very well become a burden on the healthcare system, which is paid by taxpayers, not by the company that caused it damaged. Just like when the military-industrial complex sends a young man to Iraq and he comes back a mental wreck or a physical wreck, it's society as a whole that has to pay the consequences of that, whether that is that the person ends up institutionalized on the street, murder somebody, whatever it is. It's not the big military contractor who ends up paying for that. We do. And so it's basically a sucking up of tax dollars into their profits and then sucking more tax dollars in order to clean up the mess that they make.
Right.
David, that's brilliant. I would add that the part of it that I think has been added since 1988 with these astroturfing groups and these propaganda campaigns is that they have made us complicit in our own demise. They have made us believe that, groups that propose a certain way of looking at things scientifically have our good interests at heart, that they are scientific and that the rest are not, and that they, that we can even get involved with them on a grassroots level to, say, raise awareness. Every time I hear raise awareness, I know I'm looking at a scam. Raising awareness is propaganda. And it sounds so nice. Like, why would you not want to be aware of breast cancer or autism or anything like that? What could go wrong? But so much could go wrong. They've made us complicit in our own demise. And I think that's criminal. So just if there's anything that Martin would like to add that he regrets that we weren't able to cover in this short time that we've been together.
No, I mean, there's a lot of detail, but it'd take me 20 years to go into it.
Right. Well, yeah, I know. And you've done such extensive work, and I thank you for that. I think we need more people just telling the truth and blowing the whistle on this practice and our unwitting participation in it, which I think is the most fascinating part. So thank you so much, Martin, for spending the time.
Okay.
Take care.
Liz, I think you should get hold of my book, Dirty Medicine, the first one.
Maybe I'll mail it to you, Beth, because I have a copy.
I worked my cutes on you, and you will let me borrow it.
Yeah, I'll mail it to you.
Okay.
It will sort out some of the quandaries you have at the moment about innocent people being badgered into doing this and doing that.
Yeah, one of the things I wanted to talk about was the evolution of Brian Deer, because in your book, you describe him as on, what you might say, as on our side.
Yes, definitely.
But then in the vaccine issue, he became Duncan Campbell and went on to the other side.
He became exactly Duncan Campbell, and I think that's very interesting. And I don't want to talk too much about this because I think that that argument that Brian Deer had with Wellcome, yes?
Yeah.
You're aware of that, was seminal in his development. I'll say no more than that for the moment.
Okay.
But Duncan Campbell had exactly the same quandary placed at his feet.
I'm not familiar with it. What was it?
Well, they both ended up working for the other side. And the details of that are very interesting. And you will get to know about them quite shortly, I should think.
It's in your new book?
Maybe.
Maybe. Okay. All right. I'm very curious. And please let me know. Please give me a heads up when that comes out. Okay.
Okay,
thank you for joining us today, Martin.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to episode 98 of The Infectious Myth. If you have comments, a question, or suggestions for future guests, please email me at david.curow, that's curow with an E, at theinfectiousmyth.com, or like us at facebook.com/theinfectiousmyth. Follow us on Twitter @infectiousmyth. Until next week, goodbye.